Hello and welcome back to Medic in the Middle. Hello and welcome back to Medic in the Middle. This podcast reviews a range of different topics, issues and articles all surrounding pre-hospital emergency care. It features a range of guests from various backgrounds and specialties and it's hosted by myself, paramedic and practice educator Tom Alderson. In this episode, we're really lucky to be joined by HEMS doctor and consultant anaesthetist, Dr. James Nayer, and we're going to be discussing all things paediatric trauma. Well, yeah, welcome, James. It's cool to have you on. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about your background and sort of what it is you do and a little bit about the Kid Confident program that you've got going on?
Yeah, so thanks for having me on. I'm a paediatric anaesthetist, really. I do adults as well, so I'm sort of general with a paediatric special interest. And I'm currently a full-time doctor at the Air Ambulance Service in the Midlands, working for them. And I run an education project called Kid Confident, which is the aim of that is to help paramedics gain confidence treating sick children without fear of reprisals. And we do that by providing the education which people haven't had access to before. And we just go with the truth that you don't really need to be a paediatrician to get the best outcomes for sick children. You just need a little bit of extra knowledge to build your confidence and deliver some excellent care.
Where can, like, is that on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, if people wanted to go and access that?
Yeah, so we've got a main website, which is kidconfident.org, and that's got all of our resources and posters and things that we do published on there. But we also have a Twitter account, which is at kidconfident23, and a Facebook group where paramedics and all ambulance clinicians can join and ask any questions or ask for specific bits of knowledge that they want. So that's available through Facebook groups as Kid Confident.
That sounds wicked. I have seen like some bits and bobs on Twitter, and I think that's how I kind of, as well as like mutual friends, that's kind of how I got in touch with you. It was like looking at all that Kid Confidence stuff and I thought, oh, this is quite cool.
It's quite good. It started off just for my local ambulance stations in Derby, just doing some posters, but then it sort of got a little bit out of hand, and it's quite popular now, getting about 1,000 visitors a week looking at our posters, and lots of input from lots of different people as well. So hopefully people find it useful.
Awesome. I wanted to kind of kick off the chat with a bit of a introduction to the topic which we're going to be talking about today, which is paediatric trauma and some variants, kind of nuances that involved with that. I think I'll be picking your brains quite a lot for most of it. But I have got like a couple of sort of definitions here, and I just wanted to talk about a little bit of like an overview of its prevalence and some common sort of involvements with injury patterns, I suppose, and just kind of themes that you might see involved in kids from their different age groups as well. So there's some really good information I found actually from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, but they write that, you know, children vary differently from adults sort of anatomically, physiologically, cognitively, and psychologically. And I like the way that they've kind of broke down into different age groups the different types of trauma we might expect in those different age groups as well. So they write that trauma, first of all, is the greatest contributor to childhood mortality, or one of them. And childhood activities and the changing levels of maturity and the different throughout the different age groups kind of expose them to different risks and different mechanisms that more likely to be involved. So as they kind of start from a young age, and then, for example, like more likely to fall in the playground or suffer some sporting injuries and things like that, and as they kind of progress and get older into older children or young adolescents or whatever, they're maybe more likely to be involved in motor vehicle accidents as they get mobile and are kind of a little bit more inquisitive about the world and what's around them. So for example, below 1 year old, some of the more common themes are foreign bodies, maybe burns if they're kind of starting to pick up somebody's cups of tea that's been left on the side and whatnot. And then preschoolers, kind of 1 to 4 years old, will have a bit more mobility and a bit more curiosity about the world. So but without a refined awareness of the dangers, I suppose, that is involved in activities. So there's less of an appreciation of the dangers around burns or falls or, again, sort of unintentional ingestions. And then as they move a bit older, sort of 5 to 9 years old, they're developing their sort of motor skills, and they want to be doing things like cycling, climbing, and active play. And then we might see the injury patterns that are involved in those kind of activities as they progress and get older, sort of post 9 years old or sort of 10 to 12. They actually consciously engage in risk-taking behaviours, and there's an increase in sort of road traffic accidents, assaults, unfortunately, like intentional self-harm and intoxication and things like that as they get a bit more experimental. Folk, I've talked enough now, so I kind of want to hear some of your thoughts around, I suppose, like age-specific considerations and maybe just how we're going to approach some of these injuries and what maybe about like the different kinds of injuries they might experience, like sort of head injuries and chest injuries and stuff, and how we're going to kind of initially deal with that. And I'd be interested to hear some of your thoughts around that, with, because I know you hear all kind of different trains of thought, don't you? Some people say treat kids, they're just small adults, just treat them as though they're just small adults and carry on with that. In your experience, like, what's your kind of general approach to that sort of thing?
So I buy into that children are, in the context of major trauma, children are just small adults. But I think the caveat to that is that their injury patterns are different, and as you just nicely described, the types of injuries that they're likely to sustain changes with their age. If we look at the TARN data, there was a report, severe injury in children, which describes all traumatic injuries with an injury severity scale over 15. And that was between 2019 and 2020. And that quite nicely describes the same sort of pattern of injury types that you've described. Interestingly, under ones, the most common reason for having severe traumatic injuries is suspected parental abuse, and that's usually likely to be from dad. So that's straight away a different thing going to a toddler under one with injuries than your non-accidental injury and safeguarding head has to be on, and you'll be looking for clues there, whereas that obviously differs from adults. And then as they become more mobile, more likely to suffer falls, and then risk-taking behavior, playing sports, all those factors come in as they get a bit older. And then you get your first peak in injuries of under ones, and then the second peak of injuries in children comes at about the age of 15 in the UK, and that's from the TARN data. But it's really small numbers as well. Children's trauma takes up about 3% of the total ambulance service workload, and paramedics and other clinicians are exposed to less than one every 2 years, so it's quite rare. And I think that can knock confidence and the approach to children. As children grow, their body proportions change, obviously the height changes, and so the types of injuries that they're more likely to sustain from the same mechanism as an adult changes. There's a nice diagram from the Association for Advancement of Automotive Medicine that shows how a newborn head is a quarter of their body proportion, but then when you look at a 15-year-old, a quarter of your body proportions is halfway down your chest. So you can see how the head's more susceptible in younger children, and that correlates as well with the types of injuries that children sustain. So most commonly is head injuries, and then that moves down to rapidly from 70% of severe injuries involve severe head injuries, and then the next most serious injury is thoracic injury, with only 20% of pediatric trauma patients sustaining thoracic injuries. And the difference in adults between those categories is a lot less. But bearing all that in mind, the injury patterns might be different. So your estimation of what injuries somebody's likely to have may be different in adults and children are different sizes, but the approach to those children when you're examining them and treating what you find, I think is the same as in adults. And that's why I'm a strong believer that we should be saying that children are small adults in the context of trauma, and we should remove that blockage from stopping us doing the things that we know are right to do.
I mean, that's crazy, isn't it, what you said about the encounter, like the amount that we're going to encounter these kind of jobs or these kind of injury patterns as like a regular paramedic, dare I say, kind of working out on the roads, like so small, isn't it? It makes up such a small percentage of like our workload that it's kind of no wonder that there is that apprehension naturally in dealing with these, because it's just the lack of exposure to dealing with them on a regular basis, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Like, I think that sort of apprehension is where, you know, you'll encounter like those human factors then, isn't it, of the anxiety kind of taking over, and then you're kind of overwhelmed, and it's then interferes with your cognitive load, doesn't it, and your ability to just take a step back and be a little bit more methodical.
That's it. And then you have that those pediatrician voices screaming in your head that children aren't small adults and they're really scary and bad things are going to happen if you don't do things just right. And that also adds to the cognitive load. And I think the apprehension and anxiety around treating them and doing the basics well, which I think everyone knows how to do the basics well in trauma. But, you know, without much structured training as well, for paramedics especially, it makes it really difficult to get over that and get on with what you know is the right thing to do.
Because plenty like of things, like you said, like the PHTLS kind of approach to things, and that really well structured CABCDE approach that we're so used to doing for adults. And I think there's that cognitive block then that sometimes takes over, isn't it, like you say, you get that. I think during paramedic training in particular, you certainly, for me, in my experience, like your initial phase of training, you have like a very small percentage, I suppose, of your actual overall training on kids. And it is just, they're very different. They've got some anatomical differences in their airways. They've got some anatomical differences in the way that their chest develops from a young age. And their body surface area is different to that of adults. And I think you have this, a little bit of information in the back of your mind. And you get to that pediatric job and you're like, oh, something's different here. I'm meant to be doing something different. Like you say, it all gets a bit big and scary. And I think it can then, I mean, certainly for me in my experience, it can sort of set you back a little bit then, because your standard PHTLS style approach of managing a major trauma in a kid, then your head is, it's tempting to get stuck with that. Oh my God, something's different here. I need to think about.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you do need to, you know, assessing injury patterns, which is something that we all do automatically when we arrive on a scene, is going to be different. But when you take that away and you just go and approach your patient, because that doesn't really guide you completely to what you're going to do, does it, with an adult patient, for example? But the CABC approach to assessing all ages of trauma patient is the way forward, and it's what's taught on the APLS, for example, for the pediatric life support, and it's what I advocate and teach as well when we do training sessions with groups or part of the pediatric blast injury training. It's a CABC approach, because the things that are going to kill you are the same in children and in adults, and the order in which they're going to kill people are the same as well. So if you've got a catastrophic hemorrhage, that needs taking control of immediately. Airway problems, the same. And then you move through your ABCs after that, and it's exactly the same approach. And the interventions that you do are exactly the same. You just have to remember to scale things to size, and you've got a reminder of that in front of you by the fact that they're smaller. So the same way as you would with a small adult versus a big adult, it's a small child. You need to just scale things to size. And I think that's an important thing to remember. And we all know that doing the basics well is what makes the biggest difference, rather than all the nuanced bells and whistles. So that basic, simple CABC approach is what we need to do.
Are you happy if we kind of, I don't know which how like you wanted to kind of direct this chat around managing this, but are you happy if we kind of go through it in a bit of a CABCDE model and kind of maybe stop off at each part of that and just talk a little bit about each letter and maybe some differences or some considerations as part of that? Because I know I had a couple of people come up to me before sitting down today with yourself and having a chat about it, and they were like, oh, but for example, you know, you're starting off with the C, the catastrophic hemorrhage, and they were like, oh, you know, what do we do if we have a really little one with a suspected pelvic fracture and all we've got is, you know, the ambulance standard pelvic binder kind of thing? And there were some questions around that. I had some people come up to me and ask about, and similarly with immobilization, I think there's a little bit of apprehension around, oh, what do we do if we think there might be a C-spine injury and all we've got is like a small fitting collar, but it doesn't really fit them that well, and they're really, really little, maybe 1-2 years old, and we think there might be a C-spine injury. And just little things like that, I suppose, that are going to be a bit different at each step of that CABCDE journey.
And I thought it'd
be cool, then we can kind of stop off at, like, you know, if we get to B and we talk about things like chest injuries, we can talk about like some little nuances that are going to be a bit different there with sort of, for example, with little ones, the lack of the sort of ossification of the ribs and the sternum and things like that, and how that might lead to underlying structures being a bit less well protected, maybe, and they're more susceptible to chest injuries, for example, if you've got like a 8-month-old that's been crushed or whatever, or things like the hypothermia aspect of it as well. Then with the E, we can talk a little bit about how surface area might affect worsening hypothermia.
I'm
happy to sort of kind of take it in whichever direction you want to, but I just feel that Matt may be
good
way to sort of formulate a structured approach, like a major trauma assessment of a kid. But
yeah, we can do
you're,
that.
You're the expert. You tell me about. Don't pull that face. No. I'm interested to hear your thoughts about how you, as a pediatric anaesthetist, kind of would approach a job, for example, if you had this kind of young polytrauma-esque type patient, and what's kind of going through your mind with the different considerations for your CABCD approach.
So I think the main thing that worries is my approach is going to be the same. It's going to be a CABC approach. Obviously, the main issue is equipment that we have available to be able to achieve the interventions that we need to. But the interventions are still the same. So we did an interesting work with Stop the Bleed campaign from the American College of Surgeons, which is available on Kid Confident, to do a tutorial for management of catastrophic hemorrhage. And the main difference with the management of that is that tourniquets might not fit a really small child. So if you have catastrophic hemorrhage from a really small child and you can't get the tourniquet to fit round, their limb's too small for it to go round, then it's moving on to the other techniques that you would use. So direct pressure, and if you can't put a tourniquet on, then direct pressure and packing is going to do the job in most circumstances. Improvising tourniquets is not a good thing to try, because it can be quite difficult and you can actually make bleeding worse by just causing venous obstruction, and then you get a worsening bleeding. So just if one thing doesn't work, or you don't have the equipment that's suitable size, then you just try another technique that you have available to you. The same sort of thing goes with C-spine immobilization. I mean, collars are pretty out anyway for most people now, and even children will protect their C-spine if there's a neurological injury, because it's a spinal cord injury, because it's a reflex activity. The worst thing to do is try and pin anyone down with immobilization, because you're more likely to get them agitated and for them to cause more problems. But doing the best you can, if you know if they're really small and the blocks you've got are huge and bigger than them almost, then the things using blankets to put around the side to try and keep them still if needed is perfectly acceptable. If they're moving all their limbs and moving their neck freely, then the need for immobilizing their C-spine is probably small, and it's probably not a significant thing to worry about. But if they're unconscious and you're worried about the potential for a C-spine injury after a fall from a window or something, then and you don't have the right equipment to be able to block them and immobilize them properly, then using your simple techniques such as roll blankets to go down the sides to keep everything still is perfectly acceptable as well. I think obviously immobilizing a C-spine, you have to be more mindful of their airway because they do have bigger heads and the position to keep an open airway is slightly different. It's more of a neutral position rather than a sniff in the morning air position. But again, adults have different sizes and shapes heads, and everyone will be used to adjusting their head and neck position to try and achieve a good airway. Jaw thrusts work in all ages. And so I think it's just taking a breath and seeing what's different and thinking, what would I do in an adult with a funny shaped head? I would do a jaw thrust, or I would, position the head differently until I could see that they were breathing better and their chest was moving better, or I've got a better end tidal CO2 trace and things like that. So I think it's just like playing with kids is an important thing when you're assessing them and trying to get the rapport to get them to engage with your care. You need to play with your techniques the same as you do with adults and see what works and take it from there. I think the airways, as I've said, it's just a slightly different positioning, and that will change slightly as they grow and their head becomes less proportion of their total body. But providing oxygen is still, as important as it is in any other age group, because hypoxia is going to kill them quicker than anything else. And actually they might have a higher oxygen demand because they're young. So it makes things, the basic things, more important. So I wouldn't get too hung up about, perfect immobilization of a C-spine. And if your equipment doesn't fit, then you have to adapt a little bit. So is that sort of...
Yeah, I think that kind of like hits the nail on the head with that equipment aspect of it, where we're going to be limited by the kind of resources we have to hand in definitely like a pre-hospital setting as well. Somebody was on about the pelvic splints that we carry near me.
Yeah.
And they were kind of thinking, oh, could we actually cut that to size if it was a very small child, for example? And I suppose my initial answer was, I don't really see why not. It's just kind of, as you say, it's improvising, I suppose, a little bit, isn't it, with blankets and whatever you can sort of do best approach in the pre-hospital setting of using what's available to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's totally right. I mean, the pelvic splints are a problem, aren't they? Because there's different services of different types of pelvic splints. You might have a T-pod in one service, and you might have a SAM splint, or you might have the Prometheus foam thing like we have with East Midlands Ambulance. Some of them you can cut down, so like the Prometheus ones, you can cut that down and make that size, and you need to do that with adults anyway. The SAM splint with the sewn in buckle, that can be harder to do, and they come in different sizes. And the same with the T-pod, you can cut that down and put your sort of corset strings on over the top, and that will work well in any size patient as well. But then there's some simple other interventions. So all a pelvic binder is a belt around the greater trochanters, on which closes the bottom of the pelvis to close any open book fracture type things and tamponade any bleeding. And you can achieve the same with a blanket or a sheet. What we do in theatres, the pelvic surgeons will obviously have to take off binders to be able to operate on the pelvis, but to keep the pelvis closed, tie their ankles together and tie their knees together, and that sort of has the same effect. So there's other little tricks and things that you can do to try and achieve the same thing. But there's, unlike a tourniquet, where improvising a tourniquet is a bad idea, but improvising a pelvic splint is absolutely fine. And I think it's just being willing to do that and having the confidence that you're achieving the same aim. What are you trying to achieve? I'm trying to close a pelvis. I can do that by wrapping something around the greater trochanters or closing their legs together and tying their ankles and knees together, and that will achieve the same thing.
Thank you. So you kind of talked a little bit about catastrophic hemorrhage, mobilization, airway considerations in the kind of traumatic setting, which I guess is what we're kind of speaking about today. So things that fit into our B model, interventions that we might be expected to do, like obviously with your adults, I suppose, as a road paramedic, is considering equal air entry of the chest in a traumatic setting, and is there any potential causation for unequal chest movement or unequal air entry, and things like sort of pneumothorax?
Yeah, I mean,
it's going to be different.
I think so. There's a mnemonic, isn't there, that I remember, Atom FC. So, like, trauma is a city, and you've got a football club and a police department. And the things that are important to pick up in your primary survey at the football club, so Atom FC, and that's your airway obstruction, tension pneumothorax, open pneumothorax, massive hemothorax, and a flail chest. And they can happen in children as well. I think flail chests are probably slightly less likely to happen because of the softer bones and the sort of more spongy things, but definitely pneumothoraces and bleeding into the chest can occur and does occur in children, and the approach to those is the same. So if you listen to both sides of the chest, use the stethoscope, or you notice that one side's moving better than the other, then have a suspicion that there might be a pneumothorax and it can tension. There's a smaller space, so the amount of air that's needed to cause attention will be less in a child because it's smaller. But then your management would be the same. So you can decompress. The landmarks are the same. Second intercostal space, midclavicular line. In really small children, be mindful that they have this thing called a thymus gland, which it does something to do with their immunity. And that sort of disappears as they get older. So there is a slightly higher risk of causing some bleeding by injuring the thymus gland, and the heart might sit differently in the chest because it proportionally takes up a little bit more space, so it might be more lateral, but it also might be a little bit higher in the chest. But a tension pneumothorax is going to kill them, and if you puncture the thymus gland and it bleeds a bit, that's going to be less of a problem than a tension, which is going to stop their heart being able to produce any cardiac output and keep their brain alive. So I would definitely advocate putting needles in the second intercostal space in the midclavicular line. In really small children, you can cause more injury with a left lateral approach because the heart is further over to the side, which I think makes that a safer landmark to go for anteriorly. And you have the benefit in children that they're less likely to be so obese that the needle's not going to be long enough to reach the chest cavity. Some people advocate taking the stop off the end of the cannula first so that you can hear the hiss as soon as you're into the thoracic cavity sooner, rather than sticking it all the way in and taking the needle out the middle and then hearing the hiss. And in the old PHTLS, they stick a syringe with saline on the end of the cannula so they're drawing back as you're pushing a needle in, and then you get bubbles so you know that you're in the chest, and then you can advance the cannula, which is nice and soft plastic, is very unlikely to cause any significant damage, and you've relieved the tension pneumothorax.
I would be thinking practically around that for a sec as well. Question from me is that obviously your needle selection size is going to be, I suppose, just best size fit to that child, and a bit of a guesstimation work, I suppose, isn't it, of how big that child is and what kind of size needle do you need to use in relativity for that procedure? Because I know it's a really rare procedure anyway, isn't it, that, you know, I think few road paramedics that really only ever do a handful in their career, to be honest, of like needle chest decompressions, even on adults. But with children, I suppose, you know, where I am, we recommend the ginger cannula, the orange cannula. So, yep. And with a really small children, I suppose you're going to just scale that down to size and maybe just use a smaller. What do you think?
So I think it doesn't matter. The bigger cannula I have, then you're going to get a higher flow of air out. So if you use an orange versus a pink in a child, it's going to decompress the air that's in the chest in the wrong place faster. The big difference, I guess, with children is the length of the needle and the length of the cannula. But if you do some of those tips, like taking off the end so you can hear a hiss sooner, or putting a saline filled syringe on the end and drawing back as you're advancing the needle into the chest, you know when you're in the right place. It won't be as far as it would be in an adult, and then you can still relieve the tension quickly. So I think it doesn't really matter. There's less air in there, and less air getting out a bit slower will mean that they'll decompress a bit slower, but there's less air to get out in the first place. So I think it's all swings and roundabouts. I think if you pick up an orange cannula and stick it in, it's not the wrong thing. But if you think, oh, I might go with a bit of a smaller one just because their chest wall is going to be thinner, then I think that's totally fine as well. But just bear in mind that the flow rate of air from the thoracic cavity out to the atmosphere is going to be slower because it's a thinner tube. And there's a really boring equation that we had to learn from our anaesthetics training that explains all that. But yeah, I think I don't think it makes a big difference.
Yeah, I suppose as well, just what I wanted to ask you about, because it's going to be your area of expertise as well, is if we're having to intervene with a little bit of ventilatory support in these patients as well, it's just having being mindful of, obviously they're smaller and they're going to be more susceptible to things like barotrauma, isn't it? And thankfully we do have pediatric BVMs available to most of the time on DCAs. With adults, it's kind of go for like a general rule of 6 to 8 mils per kilogram for a tidal volume. Is there a different rule of thumb for that with kids, or is it still kind of 6 to 8 mils per kilogram?
It's exactly the same. When we ventilate children in PICU or in theatres, we target 6 to 8 mils per kilo on the ventilator as well. So it's exactly the same. I think the main problem with bag valve ventilation in all patients is that the adrenaline is going in the clinician as well, and we're kind of squeezing a bag really hard, and some of the smaller children, even with a pediatric bag valve, we can overinflate the chest quite easily by doing that. So it's just remembering to use fingers rather than your whole hands, and maybe squeeze the bag with two fingers at a slightly higher rate, because they do have faster respiratory rates, and there's tools available, even like JR Calcage for Pages, brilliant, because I guide you with rates that you should be providing, but just be mindful that you don't have to be emptying the bag the whole time on every breath, and it's just smaller volumes targeting 6 to 8 mils per kilo, which is difficult to calculate in heat at the moment for everyone, including me.
Awesome. In terms of circulation, we'll see. I wanted to move on to talk a little bit about head injuries and TBIs and things like that, but I don't want to kind of jump the gun and skip anything.
With circulation, I think being mindful that children are difficult to cannulate. Even anaesthetists struggle in hospitals sometimes with cannulating little, especially really little kids. So don't be afraid to use intraosseous access. Don't be scared of growth plates and things like that, because if you save someone's life by providing IV access and circulatory support, but they grow a bit wonky, I think they're going to, at least they get to grow wonky, right, if that makes sense, rather than die from circulatory failure. So the teaching is to 2 attempts at IV access. If you don't get it, go IO. You've got your landmarks are the same as in adults, and you actually have an extra one, don't you? Your distal femur is really, really useful if you don't have any pelvic injuries. The humeral head, there are growth plates in funny places, but again, if you get into the marrow and provide circulatory support, then you have the opportunity to see the fact that they don't grow quite straight, maybe. And there's things that can be done about that. So, yeah.
That's a good point, actually, to be fair, because I think there is a fair bit of anxiety around access with kids, isn't there, naturally being smaller. And I think you've hit the nail on the head with things like IO access, I think there can be a little bit of a hesitancy to go for that humeral head sometimes with kids, because people are worried about, oh, I might cause some kind of iatrogenic injury. I might cause some harm myself by doing it. But I think it kind of puts it into perspective, doesn't it? If you're going to give them support and potentially save their life, then it's a bit of a wonky shoulder, as you say. At least they get to kind of grow old with a wonky shoulder rather than not.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's something, and you do get comments from people. I get comments from paediatricians when they take patients into hospital. You might have hit a growth plate there on that. I'll say, yeah, but they'll have an opportunity to see that they're not growing straight, rather than not having an opportunity to see their bones still not grow at all. And that usually stops them talking.
I love it. I suppose disability, then we'll move on to that. If you're happy to move on to disability and talk a little bit about the traumatic brain injury stuff that I did see actually on Twitter, you put up not too long ago a TBI poster on your Kid Confident page on Twitter for this, and I thought it was great, and I did retweet it on my Medic in the Middle Twitter as well, because I thought it was a really cool little infographic. So for those listening, go and check out the Kid Confident Twitter page and go and find that poster, because it's really good. Head and neck injuries in kids. So I've got a little bit on this, but I don't want to waffle too much again, because I'm not here to steal a show or anything like that. But you mentioned before, I think, with young children having sort of relatively large head and underdeveloped musculature in that area, they have softer skulls. There's quite a lot of literature out there, I think, sort of the Tarn database, and said some of this Australian literature as well. There's that, you know, traumatic brain injury is the leading cause of death in paediatric trauma patients, certainly in that cohort, and they're more likely to suffer with these kind of injury patterns. I want to hear your thoughts on it, really.
So it's a double-edged sword. You're right, there's is a softer skull. There might be less protection, but in the really small kids, they've still got open fontanelles, and they haven't got complete fusion of all the bones of the skull, so they can cope with a little bit more intracranial pressure than an adult, where they've got an absolutely rigid fixed box. But the thing that contributes to the most to mortality in children's head injuries are hypoxia and hypotension. So the brain needs oxygen and it needs glucose to survive, and it uses a disproportionate amount of both of those things, of oxygen and glucose, compared to the rest of the body for its size of the organ, the brain. So it's, again, back to doing the basics well, making sure you've got an airway, you're providing high flow oxygen, and we advocate that oxygen is always needed, whatever their SATs are in children with head injuries, so always provide them oxygen, and they need a blood pressure as well, and they need glucose. So children have less glucose reserves, they have less glycogen stores in their liver, their rate of glucose usage is faster when they're injured, so hypoglycemia is more common in non-diabetic head injured children, so it is important to check their blood glucose and to correct it, because they need glucose, and without it your brain can't metabolize and it will die. So there are some people who advocate keeping their oxygen sats below 100 and sort of targeting 94. That's fine, as long as you're targeting something that is not hypoxia, basically. So addressing their airway and their breathing and their blood pressure and glucose are the most important things for survivability of head injury, and all the data shows that they're the leading causes of death from head injuries in children is hypoxia or hypotension. If you have both, it's compounded and it's much worse. And there's some interesting research that's been done in Cambridge and from Barts as well, which shows this in numbers from their experience of patients that they've looked after in pediatric intensive care and their trauma units. So I think the approach to children with head injuries should be still CABC, because you have to stop catastrophic bleeding if they have another injury that's bleeding out, so that they have enough blood to transport oxygen and glucose to the brain. You need to maintain an airway, you need to give them oxygen, and you always need to give them oxygen. And you need to make sure they've got blood pressure. So a rough guide to what their systolic blood pressure should be is double their age plus 70. And that give you a rough guide, because, you know, the normal values do change with age. And that is another thing that's taken up bandwidth. So using your age page or kid cards or something that can, or knowing those equations can help you do that, and giving boluses of normal saline 10 mils per kilo to maintain a blood pressure is important. Everything else is, you know, things like, I don't want to give too much fluid because it might contribute to cerebral edema and that will increase intracranial pressure and worsen outcomes, is true, but that's really something that is for later on. And again, if you give someone too much fluid pre-hospitally, we can manage that in the hospital, and we can give diuretics, we can dry them out, we can restrict their fluids, and we can support them in other ways. But if they suffer hypoxia and hypotension, you're going to have worse outcomes, and they're preventable causes of mortality in head injuries in children.
I like that thinking. I like that. Like you said, there's that hesitation sometimes to be a bit, oh, I don't want to overload them, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that. And I think, yeah, it's a nice way of framing it, actually, that you've said, like, in hospital, we can, you know, we can make allowances for that later on. We can manage it in an ongoing way, can't we? But you just need to nail the basics and nail them right in the first phase of that injury. And then I think there's kind of, like, across the board, there's a bit of a tendency, I think, pre-hospitally, to forget that at times. It's like, I don't want to overload them, I don't want to do this. And there is going to be that next phase of the ongoing management, and whether that be an ED or an ITU setting, they're going to allow for that. There's this, like, you know, the things like, I don't want to over oxygenate my patient because then I will cause vasoconstriction cerebrally, and then I will worsen traumatic brain injury by over oxygenating them by having too little carbon dioxide. And I think there's that, you know, just in the initial phase, just do the basics and do the basics well.
Yeah.
And you're not going to cause absolute massive catastrophe, are you, by sort of them little nuances. That's more of like an ongoing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it takes hours for over oxygenation to cause excitotoxic problems with problems with, you know, with brain cells. I think CO2 is an interesting one. I think, like we were saying before, we've got a tendency to go for it on the bag ventilation, and we'll go fast and we'll give them big breaths because our adrenaline is going through. But trying to maintain a normal CO2 between 4 and 5, or 30 to 35, if you're on millimeters of mercury still, is fine. Giving them oxygen because their brain needs oxygen in order to function, and hypoxia kills in seconds to minutes rather than over oxygenation causing some potential problems in a small group of people over hours to days. And hypotension, so the ability, if you're hypotensive, you're not able to deliver oxygen or glucose to the brain, which are the two things it needs to be able to survive. So giving boluses 10 mils per kilo to maintain a blood pressure is really important, and as is addressing a glucose as well. So if they've got a BM below 4, then you need to give them some glucose so that their brain has something to metabolize and keep itself alive as well. So these basic things are really important, and the pre-hospital phase is relatively short in the patient's journey, and these interventions that we can provide out the back of an ambulance are what actually saves lives and contributes to better outcomes for the children, and I think that's really important to remember. So there's a bit of Nike, just do it, isn't there? And just, yeah,
Yeah, love it. I'm going to plug my laptop in. It's starting to get a bit flat. So I'm conscious of time and not, like, I know there is so much we could talk all day about it, but with that in mind, obviously, if you've got any bits you want to touch on, then wicked, like, let's do it. My plan was kind of done a bit of ABCD. I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about extremities and exposure. Okay. In terms of touched on it a bit with the hypothermia aspect of things and them having that difference in surface area and being a bit more susceptible to hypothermia and it being a really big consideration of increased mortality for kids.
Yeah.
But extremities and exposure, so just kind of wanted to touch a bit upon fractures, fracture management, and link that in with pain management as well, because I think maybe it's something we have a tendency maybe to underdo in smaller kids, because I think there's this worry about we're limited anyway as paramedics in terms of what's the word, arsenal of poisons for pain relief. Where I am, we've got IV morphine, IV paracetamol, obviously oral morphine, oral paracetamol as well, and Entonox. So I'd be interested just to hear your thoughts on it and maybe a little bit of reassurance with that, of that we don't want to underdo their analgesic regime just because they're little and we're worried about causing problems with morphine and things like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I think approach to pediatric pain is interesting anyway, isn't it? And that's a whole big topic itself. But I think the important things to remember is that kids will pick up on your emotions and your feelings as well. So calm and confident approach, reassurance, and all the psychological aspects, getting parents involved to help be reassure them, calm them down, reward them for, you know, remind them that you're doing really well, we're going to get this feeling a bit better, we're going to get you to hospital, it's all going to be okay. Those sorts of things are really, really important. Simple analgesics, IV paracetamol or oral paracetamol, if you can get that route, is available. Ibuprofen in slightly older kids as well, over 1 or 2 years old is fine, or over one is fine. And the combination of paracetamol and ibuprofen is really, really good. Morphine is amazing. It's not contraindicated in children. You can give it to neonates all the way through to however old you want. The dose is 0.1 milligrams per kilogram. And it's really effective analgesia, and you get the added bonus of, you know, peak effect is 20 minutes after giving it, but people stop caring about the pain a lot sooner than that. And if you've got control of their pain and you've been reassuring them and you've not been lying to them, say, I'm going to try and do the best I can with the pain, I'm going to give you some really strong painkillers, and we're going to see how you get on. Keep telling me how it's going and how we're, you know, how we're getting on with it, if it's working, if you've had enough, keeping the child as the center of your care, like you would with an adult. You wouldn't ask their partner or something if their pain relief was enough. You just ask the child. There's loads of different tools available as well. So on the Kid Confident website, we've got some pain tools, pain assessment tools available to help you guide your management, whether that's to Wong Baker faces scale or really small children that can't point out a face. We've got a FLAC scale, which is face, legs, arms, and cry and consolability scale, and you can look at that and it tells you what level of pain you should expect the child to be in, depending on how they tick the boxes on that, on the table there. There's some advice as well on those tools for what sort of analgesia to give. But morphine is absolutely safe to give in children. The risks are the same as in adults. So there is a risk of respiratory depression. There is a risk of nausea and vomiting. So give an antiemetic with it as well. Ondansetron is absolutely fine in children. The dose is 0.15 milligrams per kilogram, and that is in your JR calc as well. And it's within your scope of practice as paramedics to give it. if you're giving them oxygen anyway because they've got traumatic injuries, then as long as their sats are okay, it doesn't matter if their breathing slows down a little bit. And it's really important to treat pain in children because it has longer term effects, which will follow through into adulthood if you don't do it. So that goes from engagement with healthcare in general, so the trust that they will have for healthcare profession in general and their willingness to ask for help for medical issues in the future. There's a risk of chronic pain syndromes developing if acute pain isn't treated adequately at the point of injury, and post-traumatic stress disorder. So these are all things that are really disabling it later on in their lives, and you can make a really big difference to their whole life by giving good pain relief early on and just monitoring for the effects. And I think that's really important. In the smaller children that can't give you a 0 to 10 pain rating, then use the other tools that are available described. I think even JL Calc has the FACES scale on it as well, so in it as well. So use those tools, get them to point out where they are, and if they've got severe pain, treat them like they've got severe pain. If you can't get on top of it and you've got a long journey and it's, I don't know, you're going to somewhere like Lincolnshire where the roads are made out of mud, then ask for some enhanced care to come along, and we can give other things as well. But the whole thing with pain management in all ages, but especially children, is the different aspects. There is the drugs, but there's also the psychological and the sociological aspects of it as well. So things like distraction, consolability, telling them a story. If you can get Peppa Pig for the little ones on your iPhone on YouTube or something and give that to them, that's amazing. Doing all those things make a massive difference, and it doesn't take away from the fact that they need proper analgesia and you give morphine if they need morphine, but it definitely helps with the whole situation. It means that they're more compliant with you and they're easier to engage with, and get them to cooperate, which means that the whole of your management for everything else goes a lot more easily as well. So treating pain is really, really important thing to do, and take that holistic approach of using the tools like distraction and using the parents to console them, affection, being calm yourself, and you know, reassuring them that they are going to be okay and that you are looking after them and that you are going to keep giving them more pain relief if they need it. And never lie to them and say, oh, it's not going to hurt and blah blah blah, if I stick a cannula in and things like that, because they then you just lost them. So yeah, it's really, really important. Don't be afraid of giving it. Just monitor them the same as you would a frail person who, you know, the same risks. You're going to knock off their breathing really quickly in a 90-year-old. You're still going to give them morphine for their broken hip, aren't you? So it's the same principles that you already know. Just have to do it with Peppa Pig.
I really like that. I like what you said about the kind of remembering to keep that. I guess that, like, the human approach to it, isn't it? And it's just making all the thing more human and keeping in mind that bigger picture of, you know, it's fine for us to be very, you know, it's great for us to be really methodical about these cases, isn't it? And kind of get the clinical stuff absolutely nailed, but making sure that the other aspect of it, like you say, the psychological aspect of it and just that human approach to it, because an event like this for that kid is going to be a huge thing, isn't it, in their life, and it's going to be something they'll look back on as they do grow older. So I think making sure that they are adequately sort of their pain relief is managed properly, and just the whole holistic approach to it as well, isn't it? Like, it's going to have a long lasting impact on the way that they remember that event, and it kind of ties in with some of the last points I wanted to talk about with that support for the patient but their families as well, because they're going to remember that, aren't they? This is going to be a huge event in their lives that they're going to remember for a long time to come. And I think just we can occasionally, in the chaos of like the some of the scenes that might present at these sort of cases, it's can be a little bit all too easy to forget about the family and that extra bit of it, because I remember speaking to James Yates on the neonate episode that we did. And he was talking a little bit about this and saying that the model that the Resource Council were looking at for some of the new neonatal courses that were coming out was like a T, A, B, C, D, E, F approach, and he was talking about the, it's obviously, don't forget your catastrophic hemorrhage within that, but the T at the start was from neonatal aspects, was coming from a thermoregulation point of view. So it was like, we're putting emphasis on that because we're kind of seeing that that's getting forgotten about with neonates quite a lot. So it's like, they put the thermoregulation at the start just to remind people to do it. A, B, C, D, E, and then F they put at the end for family, friends, to remind as part of that algorithmic approach of like, oh, there's an extra bit of that that I need to remember to take into consideration.
Yeah, and I think that's really important because if you've got the family and friends, the bystanders, teachers, whoever, on side, and you're reassuring them as well, then that will carry over to the to your patient, the child, and the emotions and everything of the people that are closest to them is what they're going to reflect. And I think if you got a calmer mum and mum's reassured that you're going to do the right things and that you're looking after them and taking the best approach, then that will carry over to the child as well, and that will just help de-escalate loads of tensions on the scene, make the whole incident easier to manage, and it will lead to a better outcome for everyone as well, because that's what we're there for, isn't it, to improve people's outcomes. And if you can diffuse, it is going to be an emotional scene with parents with injured children, and I think providing that right reassurance and acknowledging them and acknowledging their beliefs and wishes and all the rest of it is really important, and that will get translated to the child as well. If mum's saying it's okay, they're on it, they're going to look after you, they're doing this, and that's only going to help. And I think it's really, really important. The thermoregulation thing as well, I think that's really important. They have, like you said at the beginning, they've got bigger body surface area, which means they've got bigger body surface area to lose heat from. And we know that, triad of death and the hypothermia coagulopathy thing. And so, yeah, keeping them warm as you would an adult trauma patient is probably more important. So getting them out of wet, cold situations onto the back of a warm truck, getting wet clothes off, blankets, heating on, really paying attention to that, I think is really, really important.
Awesome. And I think the last thing for me is just to make sure that as clinicians, I think after these kind of cases, as you said, they're really rare for sort of road paramedics or your DCA kind of paramedics, that just to look after your own welfare and make sure after these cases that you are debriefing, you are having those sort of debriefs, hot debriefs, cold debriefs and stuff with your colleagues, just to make sure that yourself, that you're dealing with them, those emotions properly, really, because I said they're rare cases for us to encounter, and I think when they do encounter it, just making sure that we've debriefed properly and sort of squashed any doubts or questions in your mind at the time, so that it absolutely don't linger and cause any problems down the line.
Absolutely. I think that's really important. Make sure everyone's okay after these sorts of jobs, because they're emotionally draining for us as well. There's not a nice thing to see injured children, especially really badly injured children. I think you do need to take yourself offline for a little bit, just decompress. Everyone needs to get around together, talk through the case. Try not to get hung up on minutiae, and I'll be careful saying this, but paediatricians, especially when you take into a hospital, are the first people to criticize every little thing, like, oh, you tied the cannula down, stuck it down the wrong way, and this, that, and the other. Try to ignore all that, and just in the back of your mind, understand that they don't know what it's like to treat anyone outside of a hospital without a whole trauma team there. And just focus on the good things that you've done. Look at the basic care you've provided and recognize that you've done the basics well, you've got them there in a good condition, you've not made them worse, and you've done the best you can. There might well be things that you can bring out of the discussion that you think that you might do differently or maybe better another time, but that's fine, that's professional learning, and that's not to beat yourself up about, it's just to think about and means that you might be able to do something a bit different the next time. If you're worried about anything, and if you're worried about any comments, you are more than welcome to join the Facebook group, for Kid Confident Facebook group, and ask us what we think, and you can do that private messages as well. We have emails from crew sometimes, or messages through Twitter or Facebook saying we've had this case, we got these criticisms, or we're worried about this. Do you think, how do you think we should have managed it? And like, you're more than welcome to do that. And I can promise that we are a supportive team, and we'll probably find that you've done an awesome job, and we'll tell you that as well. So please do that. Some of the paediatricians on the team, we've got one who's used to be a paramedic himself, so he definitely understands what people go through. And I think it's important for people to have somebody somewhere that they can contact. So that's why I would offer that to people now as well.
I'm going to go ahead and wrap up the podcast episode with that. I think we've reached about an hour, and we could, like I said, there's certain concepts we could talk all day about within this, but it's just a whistle-stop tour, isn't it, really, of like paediatric trauma and stuff. So yeah, thank you, James. Can't thank you enough for coming on, sparing your time and having a chat about it.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely, and I hope people have found it useful.
Thank you again for listening, and thank you, James, again for joining us on this episode. We hope you've all enjoyed it. As always, you can catch us on Twitter for any updates for the show on @medicmiddle. And take care, and we shall see you next time.